So, as I was saying, the officers essentially had no observation of Mr. Osmond's driving behavior. The only
Well,
observation they made.
listen, let me stop you. This is just petty. They saw him drive up on the curb at 2 o'clock in the morning as the local bars are letting out. Now, if this had been the officer saw him, say, cross the center line of the highway at 2 o'clock in the morning, wouldn't that constitute a reasonable suspicion to at least stop and check to see if he's intoxicated?
Well, I would submit to the court that the officers did not see anything. The testimony is very clear in the transcript. He was facing the other way. He heard a sound coming from behind himself, and then he turned and saw that the vehicle had driven up on the sidewalk.
Oh,
So the vehicle is already
excuse me.
at rest. But Your Honor, the point is well taken that the probative value of the driving behavior is diminished, I believe, if the observation is diminished from one sense to another sense to a less, you know, sight is a fairly specific sense, hearing less so. We have no indication of why the vehicle went up on the curb from the officer's observation.
That's the purpose of the investigation, is it? Isn't it to determine why the guy drove on the sidewalk?
It may be, Your Honor. It may be the purpose of the investigation to investigate why, if any criminal reason exists for driving up on a sidewalk. But I submit to the court that it was unreasonable in this situation, given the parallel parking zone that was there, and also unreasonable given the nature of the seizure that took place.
Counsel, this is Judge Felton. Let me ask you a question. Don't we have to consider all of this activity in the atmosphere of all the bars being letting out, a lot of people in the streets, as I understood the record, and the officers hear something that causes and draws their attention to this vehicle that's up on the curb, whether he sees it or not? Is it a public safety measure involved here?
I certainly agree that there is a public safety implication with the number of people that were on the street, Your Honor. But even if this court decides that the hearing of the sound alone warrants a Terry stop or an investigative detention, I'd like to point out that probable cause is simply not met here, Your Honor. That is my strongest argument, I believe. And I'd like to, as I said, I'd like to recite the facts as I believe the court should consider.
Let me ask you. I think we're real familiar with the facts, so I'd like to ask you about a case you rely on, the United States versus Brown, the Fourth Circuit case.
Yes, Your Honor.
That case involves a person who was arrested for drunk in public, which the court, in its opinion, says requires some evidence that the individual is impaired. The DUI statute is quite different. You're breaking the law if you have a blood alcohol content of 0.08 or more, regardless of whether you're impaired. Isn't there quite a difference between those two statutes that really makes Brown not quite so compelling?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's necessary. I mean, the officer has absolutely no way of observing a blood alcohol level without using the scientific equipment that they're provided. That's just not.
But Brown,
something
but Brown
that,
said,
as far as the 0.08 goes, that they're not relying on that for their probable cause and their reasonable suspicion. That's more of a.
But all he has to
I
do is have. He doesn't have to have any probable cause to believe the defendant is impaired under the DUI statute. All he has to do is have probable cause that he may be. Have a blood alcohol level of 0.08, and he can determine that by observation of the other indications of intoxication.
Well, Judge, if that's the case, then you know, if it's simply one may rely on the attendant circumstances of the place and the time, then essentially there's no limiting principle to the probable cause to arrest on whether or not someone may be at a 0.08 at a time when the bars are letting out. I just don't think that
well,
there's.
But we have, for want of a better term, a high crime area. I mean, I think everybody would agree that when bars let out at 2 o'clock, there's a reasonable possibility that somebody in that crowd is going to be under the influence. It's late at night. There's impaired driving. There's odor of alcohol. There's admission that he had consumed some alcohol. There's bloodshot eyes. There's all the tradition. And there is a refusal to perform many field sobriety tests or to do that which was asked of him by the officer, which the Supreme Court has held is relevant to a probable cause determination. That's Jones versus Commonwealth.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm familiar with Jones, and I would like to point out that in Jones, there has to be other attendant circumstances in order to consider those factors. And in this case, the arrest was completed before the officers had an opportunity to observe the defendant's breath or the defendant's eyes and the other attendant circumstances which the Supreme Court opinion in Jones states are necessary in order to rely on circumstantial evidence of refusal. And
well,
I think additionally...
Let me ask this question. I assume that what you're trying to suppress is actually the breath test.
Certainly.
So don't we just have to look to see if probable cause existed at the time the breath test was taken?
No, Judge. At the time of the arrest, if a person is not validly arrested for DUI, then the implied consent statute does not apply, and therefore this breath test was not authorized under the statute, and it would be inadmissible. If the probable cause existed for some other reason aside from a DUI, then the implied consent statute would not apply, and I think there would be evidentiary issues beyond simply whether or not probable cause existed much later after the arrest, after the time the BAC was rendered at the station, after he's been transported, taken away from the scene, et cetera. So the probable cause determination has to be at the time when the arrest took place, Judge. And that time is when the officers laid hands upon Mr. Osmond in this aggressive manner that was essentially uncontested. We know that this was a crowded area. We know that Mr. Osmond is down in his car below eye level of any pedestrians on the street. And we know from the record that the police didn't identify themselves as police. They just ran up and started hitting the car. Mr. Osmond testified he was surprised by that. He wasn't aware that these were police. It characterizes his response as less negative than I believe the Commonwealth would characterize it. He is responding to very aggressive behavior, surprising behavior by these police. They come up, they're banging on his car. He's startled, he's surprised. He takes a moment to get himself together. Yes, he realizes that these are officers at some point, but at the same time, I think that it's unfair to draw an inference of furtive behavior. This is much like a home entry situation. The police cannot create their own exigency. They can't make use of aggressive tactics either to escalate a situation and then expect the courts to hold defendants to a more professional standard than they themselves have acted in. Mr. Osmond is entitled to respond in kind to the way he's being treated by these officers, and it was entirely aggressive and invasive, well beyond the scope acceptable, I believe, under Terry stop doctrine or investigative detention. It was incredibly intrusive to pull him out of his car like that. So, Judge, I believe
counsel,
that
would you like to reserve the remainder of your time for rebuttal? You have about 6 or 7 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. Mr. Jeffrey, what do you have to say in response, sir?
Yeah, good morning, Your Honor. Donald Jeffrey from the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Commonwealth. As this court has said previously, and I pulled a citation this morning from the Supreme Court of Virginia, Rudolph versus Commonwealth, 277 Virginia 209, 722 Southeast 2nd, 527, that's a 2009 case. We have been told repeatedly that Terry is a pretty low threshold, lower than probable cause, way lower than preponderance. So simply to address the reasonable suspicion argument, it doesn't take very much. We do have the character of the neighborhood is relevant. I don't think that the case law supports any sort of limitation as suggested on reply that it has to be a high crime area. In fact, I think one of the cases was from the Supreme Court was an issue where there was an area known for illegal immigration as opposed to a generic high crime area. So. I think you do take into account, as the court has already indicated, the nature of the neighborhood. I believe that at a minimum, by the time the stop was effected, you had the driving behavior, you had the character of the neighborhood, and I think, it would be beyond dispute that you also have the fact that the defendant ignored at least the initial order to stop, and until such time as he submits to the police authority, he's not seized. So you have at least those three factors, and that doesn't even factor in, you know, because the police can actually direct him to exit the vehicle, potentially some of the things that happened when he was refusing to do that, refusing to take the keys out, and moving towards the console actually factor into the analysis. But to close up on that point, and I'm sorry, Judge Alston,
you
admonished us to be quiet, and I'll do that now.
Yeah. Counsel, before you move on to the next point, focusing on the rewatch of the suspicion, was there anything in the record to suggest that defendant's initial driving behavior, being up on the curb or anything like that, placed anybody at risk? Were there any pedestrians? Was there anything in the record to suggest that any pedestrians were placed at risk or that there was any circumstances that would suggest that someone was put at risk by the defendant's driving behavior?
I think this is a fair characterization of the record, Judge Alston. I don't think that there was any sort of indication that there was a direct threat. I think probably the closest you have by inference is the suggestion that there were quite a number of people out on the sidewalks and things because the bars had just let out. So obviously there's an inference.
I appreciate your candor, but would it be fair to say that there was nothing specific in the record, nothing particularized in the record to suggest that anyone was placed at immediate risk by the sounds that was heard by the officer?
As far as a direct evidence, no. I don't believe that there is. I think that's a fair characterization of the record, Your Honor.
All right. So if we were to take that, let's assume for the sake of discussion, and I appreciate your candor on that, but no one was placed at risk. Let's assume for the sake of the discussion of the argument, but no one was particularly placed at risk. Does a police officer have the authority of a reasonable suspicion standard to approach someone simply because they hear, this police officer hears something regarding a person who may or may not be parking his car?
Oh, absolutely. Because I think under RAB, which of course talks about Terry, the fact that it may be innocent conduct is not dispositive, obviously. And here, and I mean, obviously, Terry is obviously always a totality situation, so you have the character of the neighborhood. Those two facts alone, I think, are adequate before you even get into the issue of his refusing to stop the vehicle when initially directed to do so. So I think the answer to your question is yes. And I guess by analogy, Your Honor, I was thinking about this when I was preparing for this argument. Just to show how relatively low the standard is, I mean, probably the closest analogy I can come up with in the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence is Illinois v. Wardlow, where the court clearly said high crime neighborhood standing alone is not enough, but the headlong flight when the officers were there plus the character of the neighborhood was adequate. It is, I think, evidenced by those factors, again, a very low threshold. So I believe...
But wouldn't that essentially give the officers the ability, I'm going to use an analogy, to fish in an overstocked river? In other words, okay, I need to, I'm not suggesting this officer did this, but all right, I want to go down Wilson Boulevard because I know that there are a lot of drunks that are coming out of the bars down there at 2 o'clock at night, and I know that this is going to be easy pickings because one of them is likely to get in his or her car and drive drunk. So I'm just going to go down there and pick one, and because there are pedestrians walking around and we've got a safety implication, it essentially allows me to pull over anybody or go approach anybody that I want. Does it go that far?
No, I don't think it goes that far. I think what you have here is demonstrated conduct from which one could draw the conclusion that his motor skills are impaired, and this isn't just by inference because the people are just spilling out of the bars. You have the fact that the people are spilling out of the bars, plus the fact that the defendant is up on the sidewalk. I think that's the distinction. To follow up on what you just said, you probably could fairly aggressively force consensual encounters under that scenario, but that's not really responsive to your question. But no, I think it's the character and then the conduct of driving the vehicle up onto the sidewalk, which, again, and I think we all would concede that could be innocent conduct. It could be poor parallel parking.
But that's not the standard. It's the officer has the authority or prerogative to approach it, even if it is innocent conduct, if the reasonable articulable suspicion standard is met. So I think even your opponent colleague would agree with that.
Correct.
Mr. Jeffries, this is Judge Patty. I want to ask you about this probable cause issue.
Okay.
This is not a constitutional probable cause question in the sense that there was a search incident to arrest or something like that. It's more of a statutory issue. I think Mr. Robinson correctly noted that the refusal statute requires the breath test when one has been lawfully arrested or for a DUI. When do we look to determine when that lawful arrest occurred? Is it when the person is first detained under circumstances that a reasonable person would believe that he was in custody, or is it later when the breath sample is actually taken?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Judge Petty, and I was kind of scratching my head when you asked my opponent that. I will tell you, for purposes of writing the brief, I assumed, and it may have been a tacit assumption based on some other jurisprudence from one of the two appellate courts that I'm just not recalling, but I assumed that if the arrests were unlawful, that there is at least some argument that the subsequent breathalyzer test would be a fruit of an unlawful arrest. If you want additional briefing on that, I'll be glad to do it.
If this were a search incident to arrest, for instance, we'd look at the level of information, quantum of information available to the police officer at the time the search occurred. We'd say, was he lawfully arrested at the time the search occurred? But here we're looking at a statutory requirement that may relate back to an earlier moment.
Correct. And the question is, if I understand your question correctly, the question is, does the exclusionary rule apply if the officer had probable cause at the time the breath test was administered? I think I understand your question correctly.
Yeah. Versus, does he have to have probable cause at the time that he puts him in handcuffs and puts him in the car?
I suspect, when I heard the defense counsel's response to this, I suspect that there is a good argument based on the statute and the lawfulness of the arrest that's required that it has to be at the time of the arrest, and that otherwise it is a potentially suppressible fruit. I mean, this is not going to be a wholly satisfactory answer, but I guess I'll give it to you twofold. If you'd like additional briefing on that, I'll be glad to do it. I do think that, for reasons I stated in my brief, probable cause existed at the time the arrest was effected, so I'm not sure it's an issue you need to reach, but my initial impression, although I certainly understand the question that you asked, and to be honest, it wasn't something I had given a whole lot of thought to, my initial impression was that it probably would have to be at the time of the arrest, or otherwise there might be.
That begs the question then, when did the arrest occur? At what point was he actually arrested?
Okay, I think, let me break it down, because as I noted on brief, there really isn't a litmus test in rapidly evolving situations like this for when something evolves from a Terry stop into a formal arrest. I would suggest to you it goes out probably, even after the point he got out of the car. But again, I don't know that that's an issue you need. And by the way, I didn't cite, I believe it's in Royer. I didn't cite Royer for that specific principle, but that is in Royer, the fact that there's not a litmus test on this Fourth Amendment issue. Remember that the circumstances were evolving quickly. We know under Terry that you can not only tell somebody to leave a vehicle, but you can use force to effect the Terry stop if that's necessary.
Well, can we assume at a minimum that he was arrested at the point he was provided his Miranda rights? I think he was in handcuffs at the time.
I don't think that you can assume that for the reasons that I stated on brief. I think that this happened very quickly. And I think, again, as it indicated on brief, there's not a litmus test. I think there's an argument And there's, I actually cited an unpublished opinion from this court that said, you know, the fact that you were in a position where Miranda rights were given or even required, because that case was a back of the police car case, doesn't mean that a Terry stop has evolved into an arrest for Fourth Amendment purposes. And I cited that case on brief. It's a 2007 case from this court, and I think that's certainly consistent. It's an unpublished opinion. Asher, I think, is the name of the case, and I don't think you can assume that. I think there's a good argument that even then the arrest, if there wasn't an arrest for Fourth Amendment purposes. But remember, for probable cause purposes, at a minimum, you've got all the things that we talked about before the officer even approached the car and the failure to stop. And in terms of probable cause, I think even the defense would say, you know, at a minimum, I mean, at best, his best case scenario is that the arrest didn't occur until the officers laid their hands on him. And by that point, you had all the other conduct that we discussed earlier. You had the multiple refusals to put the car in park, to take the keys out of the vehicle, take the keys out of the ignition, which I don't think he ever did. He did ultimately put it in park, I believe. And then you also had him reaching towards the center console. I say reach. That I think actually the language was he moved his upper body in that direction. So I think you draw a couple of potential inferences aside from the safety issues that work into your Fourth Amendment analysis. And I guess an officer could draw at least two different inferences from that. One is that the person, it's a consciousness of guilt that he's trying to.
The Supreme Court doesn't like that phrase. That was Jones. They specifically said we're not going to use consciousness of guilt.
Well, I think the other thing that the second piece of it, I think, is also that one inference you could draw from it is impairment, that someone has bad judgment, especially the part about reaching towards the console, but also refusing the multiple commands from the police. And so I think you've got all the conduct that preceded it. And at a minimum, you've got all those refusals and the moving towards the console, which even under the best case argument for the defense, all those things preceded any laying on of the hands. But to circle back to your original question, Judge Petty, and I cited you all the authority in the brief. I'm not going to belabor that point with you, but I think there's an argument that even up to the point where Miranda was given and the response about the drink, having had a drink, was given by the defendant that there had not been an arrest for Fourth Amendment purposes. And again, the only thing that I didn't, as I said, for that purpose, cite on brief was Royer, but that language is contained in Royer, that there really is no litmus test on that point. And I cited you some other cases, including the one that I talked about from this court.
All right, counsel, your time has expired. Would you like to summarize your closing?
The only thing I'm going to say, Your Honor, is that obviously the touchstone of any Fourth Amendment analysis is reasonableness. I think given the factors that preceded any stop in this situation, provided the low threshold under Terry and that probable cause existed even before the officer laid hands on the defendant, and for those reasons, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Robinson, you have about 7 minutes, sir.
Thank you. So I'd like to begin by talking about the moment of arrest and what tests we do have in Virginia. In Virginia, the common law of arrest does govern arrest. There are several cases that are directly on point. I'm going to cite Hall versus Commonwealth, which is a 55 Virginia Appellate Reporter 451. And in that case, which was affirmed by the Supreme Court of Virginia, the law is stated very well. It quotes Cavell versus Commonwealth. There can be no arrest at common law without either touching or submission. The opinion goes on to say that, it would be otherwise had the officer touched the arrestee for the purpose of apprehending him, because the touching for the manifested purpose of arrest by one having lawful authority completes the apprehension, although he does not succeed in stopping or holding him even for an instant. And this test is echoed in California versus Hodari D, although they're sort of addressing the opposite issue in that case. I think the test is very clearly announced as far as when the arrests take place. What we have is an arrest that was not only announced by the officer at the time the attendant facts and circumstances are clear what's happening here to anyone who was observing. And there were many people observing, Your Honor. And I think that that leads into another point I'll make later. But I will say that the objective circumstances of this arrest, you know, it's an invasive situation, like I indicated earlier, beyond what would be acceptable in a normal Terry stop. And for those reasons, I think alone that it meets the Hall test for completion of the arrest at the time of the laying on of hands. And
Mr. Robinson, does the record indicate where he was after he was handcuffed and while he was being questioned?
I believe it was just outside the car, but I don't. There's no indication he was moved anywhere on the record, but I can't say from the record that there's an indication that he was taken from one place to another. I mean, I know that it was before he was transported.
The reason I ask that, in Dixon versus Commonwealth, the Supreme Court held that being restrained in handcuffs and placed in a locked police patrol car was a curtailment of freedom ordinarily associated with a formal arrest. But it said, while the presence of either of these factors in the absence of the other may not result in such curtailment, where both are present, an arrest has occurred. So how does that case impact your argument that he was actually arrested even before the handcuffs were put on?
Well, I think those, as far as the distinguishment of one factor being present without the other, I think these cases are very factually distinguishable. Dixon does not contain the sort of carjacking-like situation where the officers literally yank him out of the car, open the door while he's talking to them. I don't think that's a comparable situation. It is a totality of the circumstances test, and so I believe the aggressive behavior of the police is a factor properly considered by the court, and I think it affects the other factors relied on by counsel. I'd like to speak about them. There's a talk of refusal of the command to stop. As I stated, there's no indication that he even knew the command to stop had occurred with the crowd that was out there, and the fact that the officers had not identified themselves, they're not flashing their lights and siren or anything like that. This is a foot stop, so they run up and they start slamming on the car. And with this crowd of people who, you know, the Commonwealth is contending is sort of an unruly, unsafe bunch, that would indicate that it's a surprising situation for Mr. Osmond, and he could be taken aback. So the fact that he is briefly refusing to stop the car, I think, is indicative of not only the way in which the seizure was conducted, but also just the overall situation that was going on. The fact that he's moving his upper body close to the console after getting into this sort of a heated, aggressive argument with the officers. It may not be the most courageous response to officers jumping into your car after you, but I think it's indicative of his fear of what was happening in the situation and his surprise at being seized in such an aggressive manner. But I believe that the moment of arrest in the test announced in Hall or in Cavell is very clear here. If Mr. Osmond had run away, he could be convicted of escape. I mean, it's fairly obvious from the test announced in Hall, which was a case where they were determining the legitimacy of an escape conviction, that Mr. Osmond would be risking an escape conviction if he were to run away. So to say that it was a minimal sort of detention, I think, is understating what had happened here in the most fair sense as far as the level of invasiveness that had gone on, cuffing, Mirandization, and being physically removed from his vehicle, where no preliminary sort of questioning had gone on about the licensure, the registration, anything that would normally attend a traffic stop just didn't happen here. It just didn't happen. And the fact that the officer's testimony, he relies on the fact that the car seemed to be pulling back into traffic, that's directly refuted by the video that the defendant admitted into evidence. The car came to arrest still on the curb. There's no way it was in traffic and on the curb at the same time. And so I think there's really an issue here as far as, you know, what took place that night and just how aggressive the defendant was being versus how aggressive the other people there were being towards him. Finally, I'd like to talk about something relied on in the brief of the Commonwealth.
You got about a minute, sir.
Yes. The Commonwealth relies on the stated judicial policy of suppression being a last resort due to the costs it imposes on society. And this policy does recognize the inherent balancing of interest in the reasonableness requirement of the Fourth Amendment. I believe that it's time for courts, and I contend that this court should recognize a counterbalancing interest of maintaining the integrity of civilian police relations. Mr. Osmond's encounter with these police officers was swift, it was brutal, and it was public. And I think recent events have made it very clear that this type of conduct does come at a price to our society, and it's no less legitimate than the costs imposed by suppressing evidence due to misconduct. And, you know, this encounter will remain with Mr. Osmond each time he interacts with the police officers for the rest of his life, and it will probably impact many of the people who made up the crowd there that night as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your argument, and Judges Felton and Petty, we now will retire to conference. Thank you very much.